Another hostage held in Gaza has been rescued.
We cannot go into many details of this special operation, but I can share that Israeli commandos rescued Kaid Farhan El-Kadi from an underground tunnel.
Plus, Russian bombardment of Ukraine continues for a second straight night.
Both attacks targeted mainly Ukrainian energy infrastructure and caused severe destruction across the country and electricity shortages for Ukrainians.
And later, rising seas in the South Pacific, a simple treatment for farmers that can increase profits, and what Chinese development has to do with unrest in Pakistan. Today is Tuesday, August 27th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint.
Good evening, I'm Lori London, along with Steve Karish in Washington. We begin today's show in Ukraine. Russia unleashed a second consecutive day of widespread airstrikes, largely aimed at civilian infrastructure. For the latest, we turn to our correspondent, Anna Chernikova, in Kyiv.
Russian forces launched another massive missile and drone attack across Ukraine on Tuesday, the second day in a row. The attack on Tuesday was, however, smaller, involving 10 missiles and 81 drones in comparison to the Monday attack, which involved 127 missiles and 109 drones. Both attacks targeted mainly Ukrainian energy infrastructure and caused severe destruction across the country and electricity shortages for Ukrainians. Explosions were heard in Kyiv, Kryvyi Rih, Rivne, Sumy, Zaporizhia, and Khmelnytsky. Zelensky reported that at least 4 people were killed and 16 injured on Tuesday. Also on Tuesday, a ballistic missile hit a hotel in the central Ukraine city of Kryvyi Rih. At least 2 people were killed and 5 were injured, and some could still be under the rubble. The rescue operation is ongoing. Local authorities said the building was wiped out.
I felt a very big fear and didn't know what to do.
Olena lives nearby. She said it was very scary and she didn't know what to do other than follow neighbors to the shelter. On Sunday, Russian forces also used a ballistic missile to hit the hotel in Kramatorsk, Donetsk region, where Reuters journalists were staying. The journalists were citizens of Ukraine, the US, and the UK. The body of one of the Reuters journalists, a British citizen, was found under the rubble. 2 more journalists were taken to the hospital, one of them, a Ukrainian cameraman, is in serious condition. He is still in a coma and is awaiting several operations, the doctor said. Meanwhile, President Zelensky announced that there would be retaliation for the attack on August 26. In his evening address, he said that he discussed the response to Russia with Commander-in-Chief Alexander Sirsky, and said that they were talking about the use of F-16 fighter jets and the operation in the Kursk region. During a press conference on Tuesday, Zelensky confirmed that Ukraine used F-16 fighter jets to help repel the Russian massive attack on August 26. He also made some statements on Ukraine's plans for the Kursk operation. The president noted that among the goals of the operation in the Kursk region, which he can name, is the end of the occupation of the Kharkiv region, the non-occupation of Sumy and Chernihiv regions, the destruction of Russian troops, and the withdrawal of Russian forces. According to Zelensky, there are other parts of this plan, in particular, a package to force Russia to end the war through diplomatic means. Zelensky said that the whole plan will be presented to the President of the USA, Joe Biden, in September, because the success of this plan depends on the USA. He will also present the plan to both Harris and Trump.
I think it's fair if I present this plan first to the President of the United States. From him depends the success of this plan.
Zelensky also announced that Ukraine has successfully tested the first ballistic missile produced in Ukraine, though he did not provide any details. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And now a developing story from Israel. The IDF says its forces rescued another of the hostages taken when Hamas invaded southern Israel on October 7th. 52-year-old Kaid Farhan El-Kadi had been working as a guard in southern Israel when he was seized by militants. Al-Qadi, a Bedouin Arab, was rescued during what the military called a complex rescue operation. Daniel Hagari is an Israeli government spokesperson.
We cannot go into many details of this special operation, but I can share that Israeli commandos rescued Qaid Farhan Al-Qadi from an underground tunnel following accurate intelligence. His medical condition is stable and he will undergo examination in hospital. His family had been waiting 326 days to receive the news they did today.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu congratulated Al-Qadi and told him that all of the people of Israel were moved by his being freed.
A separatist group claimed responsibility Tuesday for the deadliest day in recent history in Pakistan's Balochistan and warned that even more intense and widespread attacks are coming. At least 70 people were killed in Monday's coordinated assaults on police stations, railway lines and highways. And then security forces retaliated. VOA's Sarah Zaman is VOA's Pakistan bureau chief. She joins us from Islamabad.
The group is BLA, the Baloch Liberation Army. It's a banned militant outfit in Pakistan, and it has occupied a central role in the current wave of insurgency that's been happening in Balochistan since the early 2000s.
And what led to this latest chaos? I know this is a resource-rich province, and there are some issues as far as development with China. What can you tell us more specifically about what their major concerns are leading them to launch these attacks?
So Balochistan actually has a very long history of insurgencies. In fact, right now, the province is in the middle of its fifth wave of insurgency. And what primarily has been driving these insurgencies is this idea that the state is trying to take away Balochistan's resources and it's trying to maintain its hegemony, whereas the Baloch feel that they should be they are the primary stakeholders and they should have greater autonomy and greater decision-making. What has happened in these last 20 years is this idea that the insurgency has actually moved away from tribal groups that used to be at the helm of the insurgency. Now it has shifted to a larger middle-class-based youth that is gravitating towards BLA. And as far as their grievances is concerned, again, in this wave of insurgency also, the idea is that the development that's happening in Balochistan, whether it's coming from, you know, China, whether it's these big mining projects that are being funded by China, that this, again, is seen as the state disempowering the Baloch, not involving them in the process, and stealing their vital resources. This attack, which was quite brazen and unusual because there were multiple coordinated attacks within one day, the timing was noteworthy because it came on the anniversary of the death of a very well-known and popular Baloch leader, Baloch tribal leader, Akbar Bugti. And he was somebody who had also held the role of the chief minister in Balochistan at one point, but in the early 2000s, he had a falling out, and him and the military dictator of that time, Pervez Musharraf, had a falling out, and then eventually Bugti was killed while he was in hiding, and he was killed by the military. So the Baloch are also, they have been upset for years about that assassination as well. So this attack came on the anniversary of that, so analysts see, you know, the timing as very significant. As far as the grievances are concerned, those aren't new, but a continuation of what the Baloch have felt for decades.
This also appears to be one of the most widespread assaults in a long time, has it not?
Yes, it was rather widespread. We have not seen something like this happen in Balochistan, where in several different places they would coordinate attacks. Another thing that was important was that one of the attacks in which 23 civilians were killed after being identified, that happened very close to the border with Punjab province. Punjab is Pakistan's biggest province population-wise, and it's also the center of power. And for people in Balochistan who see the state as an aggressor, for them, Punjab also in a way represents that aggressive force. And then workers from Punjab who come and work in Balochistan, they are also now being seen as part of that aggressive, part of that outsider machinery that's coming into Balochistan and taking away jobs. So even though a lot of these people come to do very low-skilled, labor-intensive work, the gripe is that why shouldn't these jobs be given to people from Balochistan? Why should people from other provinces be coming?
Is there an overall feeling among citizens and the population in general there that while they would
wouldn't resort to these sorts of violent attacks. Do they have some sort of agreement as far as feeling that they're not getting their fair share of the resources available in the region?
So the feeling of being marginalized is widespread. And what we're seeing lately is that along with this insurgent, this armed resistance, there's also a renewed vigor in non-armed, completely civilian, you know, forces that have come forward, and they have occupied a very popular political space that many political parties were forced to exceed because of interference by state institutions. So there is a primarily women-led movement right now, and basically it started as a movement to draw attention to the issue of missing persons in Balochistan, but now it has evolved into a civic rights movement where this group has massive support, and they have been going from city to city in Balochistan. They even came all the way to the capital, Islamabad, with their demands. And their idea now is that we're going to go across the province and we're going to raise awareness about civic rights, about all the, whether it's development, education, the facilities that we don't have in Balochistan, but people in other provinces have. So yes, the feeling of being marginalized and not having the stake in your own affairs is widespread. And there is a very popular civilian movement. But the fact is that the government and state institutions have also tried to malign that movement, which is again further aggravating the sense of manipulation, interference, and undue negative propaganda about forces that people feel represent their concerns and their interests.
VOA Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman in Islamabad.
Just as Chinese development in Pakistan is cause for concern, in some regions, the Chinese and American relationship is also a priority for the Biden administration. AP correspondent Donna Warder reports on a top White House official's trip to Beijing to work on the two countries' growing differences.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has arrived in China for 3 days of talks in hopes of maintaining communication in a relationship that has broken down during the Biden administration. Ahead of the trip, Sullivan said that likely to be discussed with his Chinese counterparts is overcapacity.
Massive subsidies going into the Chinese electric vehicle industry have eliminated a level playing field. And so part of the economic response the U.S. has taken is responding to that.
The Biden administration has taken a tough line on China, restricting the access of its companies to advanced technology and confronting China as it tries to exert influence over Taiwan and the South China Sea. I'm Donna Warder.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Lori London in Washington. What's something simple that can help farmers increase their profits? The answer, it turns out, is plain to see. That story coming up. But now to the South Pacific. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling another climate SOS to the world.
The world must look to the Pacific and listen to science. This is a crazy situation. Rising seas are a crisis entirely of humanity's making, a crisis that will soon swell to an almost unimaginable scale with no lifeboat to take us back to safety. But if we save the Pacific, we also save ourselves.
Speaking to reporters in Tonga, where the Pacific Islands Forum is being held, he highlighted a report showing the Southwest Pacific is being hit the worst by rising sea level, in some places more than double the global average in the past 30 years.
And Pacific Islands do not contribute to climate change. So they have a moral authority to ask those that are creating this and accelerating the sea level rise to reverse this trend.
Climate change and security are dominating discussions at the week-long annual leaders meeting, where the 18 members of the Pacific Islands Forum span atoll nations threatened by sea level rise, such as host Tonga, as well as Australia, one of the biggest exporters of coal.
More than 30 African countries are being represented at a military law conference that begins in Lusaka, Zambia, on Tuesday. In this story, narrated by Steve Miller, Bekondisi Dube reports that participants will discuss the role of legal advisors in the deployment of troops as conflicts threaten stability across Africa.
The four-day African Military Law Forum is co-hosted by the Zambian Defense Force, the U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, U.S. Army Europe and Africa, as well as the North Carolina National Guard. Participants, who include military leaders and magistrates, will focus on legal advisors and their role in deployment of troops to missions. AFRICOM's deputy legal counsel, retired Colonel Max Maxwell, says it is critical to ensure the rule of law is followed when troops are deployed.
What I mean is soldiers are held accountable, commanders have legal advisors, and soldiers are inculcated in professionalism. In the end, we want armies that the people run to, not run from.
Maxwell says promoting professional conduct is crucial for the successful execution of the troops' mission.
This standard of conduct promotes partnership and helps focus militaries on the rule of law, specifically professionalism, which is critical. And it is especially true in the face of increased challenges in more complex conflicts.
Malawian Brigadier General Dan Kuali says the Zambia meeting will also discuss ways to help soldiers avoid human rights violations during deployments. Malawi has deployed hundreds of soldiers in the conflict-torn Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo as part of the Southern African Deployment Community Mission.
We are here to build capacity as legal advisors in order to help our troops to avoid violations, but also to be able to ensure accountability for violations.
The seventh military law forum is held at a time when the United States is bolstering military and security ties with African partners. Africa is battling increased instability, particularly in the Sahel region, where an Islamist insurgency has ramped up attacks. For Kondisi Dube, I'm Steve Miller, VOA News.
And there's a treatment for a common physical ailment that has prevented farmers from earning as much as they could. You might say the answer is hiding in plain sight. Research shows that farmers could boost their profits significantly with just a simple pair of eyeglasses to correct poor vision, but millions of people are still unable to access them. VOA's Henry Ridgewell has that story.
Growing cocoa is an intricate task. Farmers hand-pollinate the plants, transferring tiny pollen grains from the male to female flowers. For years, 63-year-old cocoa farm owner Juliet Adai from Ghana struggled with blurry vision.
It was difficult to work around my farm, to do the pollination, to do the pruning.
With the help of the US-based charity Vision Spring, Adai obtained eyeglasses to help with her poor vision. She says it has transformed her working day.
Before I had the glasses, I would get 8 to 9 sacks of cocoa a year. But with the glasses I have, I was able to work on the farm and get 12 sacks. So it has really improved my livelihood.
Vision Spring says half of cocoa farmers in Ghana's Asante region require eyeglasses to help correct their vision. Research conducted in Bangladesh by the charity and Queen's University Belfast showed glasses can increase income among rural workers by a third, from an average of just over $35 per month to over $47. The glasses themselves cost around $6. Ella Goodwin is the CEO of the Vision Spring charity.
A very modest investment in vision correction for farmers and for artisans and skilled tradespeople yields a pretty massive return on investment in terms of the household income that they are able to continue to earn. It's one of the few tools in the International Development Toolbox that can be deployed to increase income in farming communities that has yet to be used.
Ghanaian cocoa farmer Juliet Adai said the extra income has helped pay for her family's education, helping them in turn to increase their future earnings. The research was published in the journal PLOS ONE. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
And finally today, Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Walz has been seen by supporters as a model for modern American masculinity, who is just as comfortable being a hunter as he is with progressive issues. One of those issues he has supported and been mocked for has brought to light something that even in the world's wealthiest nations, some people struggle to be able to afford, and that's menstrual products. Advocates say they hope the attention will shine a spotlight on period poverty, a problem familiar to the developing world. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz signed a 2023 state law mandating free menstrual products in schools, thus earning the moniker opponents have strung around his neck as he seeks the vice presidency. Tampon Tim. Presidential candidate Donald Trump at a recent rally in North Carolina.
He wants tampons in boys' bathrooms. I don't think so. Tampons.
Menstrual health advocates argue the law does not say that. It says only that supplies must be provided in restrooms regularly used by students in grades 4 to 12. This, they say, gives schools flexibility over where to stock them. What this law actually does, they say, is shine a light on the problem that prompted Minnesota State Representative Sandra Feist to present the bill in 2022, after high school students lobbied her.
One out of every 10 menstruating youth miss school because their menstrual cycle, during their menstrual cycle, due to a lack of access to menstrual products and resources. This absenteeism impacts educational attainment directly and indirectly through its correlation with increased depression and anxiety.
U.S. studies find that nearly one in four menstruating students have trouble affording supplies. The average monthly cost here is about $9. About 25 U.S. states have passed laws providing free products in schools. Estimates of the cost to the government vary widely, but advocates say the benefit eclipses the cost. Minnesota estimates their program costs about $2 per student per year, while other American school districts describe similar estimated costs, with one as high as $29 per student annually. Michaela Bedard is executive director at Period, an advocacy group.
It is a very inexpensive solution to attendance problems, to making sure that people are fully comfortable in their bodies and able to engage at school. We talk a lot about attendance and graduation rates. This is an affordable, easy solution for that.
Campaigners suggest a number of moves, like making supplies available through federal health and educational programs, by eliminating sales taxes on hygiene products, and by adding them to the list of items available through assistance programs. And they point to a pending bill that would, in addition to some of those things, require that all employers of more than 100 people provide free supplies. VOA asked both presidential campaigns to outline how they would address period poverty if elected. Neither responded. Opponents of similar state-level initiatives have not always given clear reasons for their opposition, often painting it as a cost issue. In June, Florida's governor vetoed a $6.4 million plan to provide free pads and tampons for kindergarten through 12th grade students in his state. Bedard told VOA that younger Americans are more willing to talk about this openly and are the force behind many of the new state laws. She said Walz should take a cue from today's teens and wear his nickname with pride.
I love it. He is Tampon Tim to me. He's my kind of governor. I think that we need to lean into names like that because it normalizes all the work that we at Period have been doing for years. This is not a controversial issue, especially for the many young people who are in our nation's schools.
And it's one with global appeal. Among the countries with existing legal protections or considering them, according to the American Bar Association, are Australia, Canada, Chile, China, Japan, Scotland, Spain, Taiwan, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of Lori London and everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.